from WNYC New York Public Radio. This is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show. This is just one segment of the program. You can hear all Leonard's interviews on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
Today, 350 million Africans live on less than a dollar a day. And until this morning's tragic events in London, the focus of this week's G8 conference was largely on increasing aid to Africa. But is foreign aid the best way to address this poverty? And what else is going on in Africa? Well, John Chiahaman, Reuters chief correspondent for Southern Africa, joins me now. Over the past 25 years, Mr. Chiahaman has reported on much of sub-Saharan Africa, the liberation struggles, civil wars, and elections in South Africa, Zimbabwe, Sierra Leone, Mozambique, and elsewhere. I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show today. Hello.
Hi, my pleasure.
Despite this morning's bombings in London, British Prime Minister Tony Blair is insisting that the leaders stick to the agenda of climate control and aid to Africa when the talks resume tomorrow morning. Why has President Bush refused so far to meet his specific challenge of giving Africa $50 billion of foreign aid by 2010?
Well, obviously, I can't answer for George Bush. But all I can
what is he saying?
Well, I think he's saying that he doesn't want to be committed to any specific targets, and he wants to look at this in terms of an overall package that was agreed between the African nations and the G8 nations at Kananaskis in 2002. This is what is called the G8 Africa Action Plan, which encompasses a much wider range of commitments and engagements by the G8 to Africa. And apart from that, you also probably know that George Bush has his own Millennium Challenge account, which is a different track of aid designated specifically for countries that have met certain specific criteria of good governance and so on. A number of countries have qualified for that so far, and I think one has got some disbursement under that, Madagascar.
There's seven altogether,
yep.
And that includes Egypt. The criteria for aid recipients are no corruption, investment in education and health, and encouraging commerce. No corruption in Egypt?
I'm impressed.
You're impressed what? I mean, in the end, doesn't this really become very fluid as to who might apply and who might not?
Absolutely. I think he's completely entitled to have his own policy, if you like, instruments to use in order to nudge whether countries in the direction of democracy or whatever. But I think by far the most important thing in this whole business is to put Africa on a sustainable path, and this is what a lot of African countries are thinking of now. Ordinary people in Africa that you talk to will tell you that they are not so much interested in aid as a handout, but they would like aid reconfigured in a way that helps Africans to help themselves. Whether this is, and the most obvious way of doing that is to encourage investment from the developed countries. By far, the avenue for creating jobs in Africa, which is a major problem, is through private investment. And I think we have seen examples of where that is beginning to make a difference in Africa. And one example that I always cite is in the area of telecommunications, where there has been a phenomenal leap a revolutionary leap in investment in telecommunications, and this is impacting on a wider range of sectors in the whole countries of Africa.
But doesn't that suggest that President Bush's approach is a good one, because you can't have serious investment until you've eliminated a certain amount of corruption? The money actually has to go to what it's allocated for.
That's very true. In fact, people in Africa will never complain. We cannot have too much emphasis on good governance and reduction of corruption. And we can see that the pressure that countries like the United States have made in this direction are beginning to bear fruit. You are beginning to hear more governments in Africa talk of zero tolerance to corruption. And it's not just talk. I give you two examples. Last month in South Africa, President Mbeki took the bold decision to sack his deputy, a very popular politician, because he was only indirectly implicated in a corruption trial of his former financial advisor. It was a decision fraught with a lot of political risk, but he took it all the same to set a very good example, because he has been, that is President Mbeki, has been at the forefront of trying to bring about reform across the continent. And his colleague in Nigeria, President Obasanjo, whose country has consistently featured at the top of the list of most corrupt nations, has also been taking very bold steps. And we saw his chief of police dragged to court in handcuffs. This is unprecedented.
In a country where corruption is just the norm. My guest is John Chiohaman, who is Reuters' chief correspondent for Southern Africa. And he is my guest on today's Unreported segment on WNYC 93.9 and WNYC.org. Meanwhile, on AM 820, you can hear BBC's special coverage of today's events in London. Well, on the other hand, the countries where the ordinary people's needs are greatest are often the ones where the governments are least likely to meet President Bush's standards. Sudan, for example, Sierra Leone, Liberia, countries that have gone through terrible turmoil and do not have real stability.
Yes.
So what happens to the ordinary people in those countries? Do they starve because the feeling is there should be investment, which will take a while to actually have some kind of impact, or that no money should be given to countries which don't have government without corruption?
Well, there's always a distinction between aid that is targeted to investment and budgetary purposes, as opposed to humanitarian assistance.
This is where the NGOs come in. They go down into the field.
And also, even on a governmental level, USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, is still carrying on its humanitarian work, even in these countries that you mentioned. At the end of the day, I return to the belief that these countries need to be helped in the areas that will most impact on producing people who are skilled to carry out the jobs that take Africa forward, improving manpower, helping to rebuild shattered universities and so on. And this has two ways. It keeps Africans back in Africa instead of wondering about in Europe and the United States looking for small jobs.
What is Tony Blair calling for?
Well, Tony Blair is calling for two things. One is an increase in the amount of aid that comes into Africa from a level of about $25 billion at current today.
No strings attached?
Well, there is also talk of good governance. You remember that before the report was prepared, they went across the continent. There were a lot of workshops held, a lot of meetings with government, and at each of these, the issue of corruption was also stressed. But I don't think there's any statutory, mandatory conditions attached to that.
It's been suggested that Tony Blair's approach had a positive effect on the Olympic bid for 2012. We're not going to say that his emphasis on African aid now rather than last year or the year before has any kind of a subtext. But why do you think now, this year?
You mean why Tony Blair is pushing for this?
We haven't heard a lot about African aid from him in the past few years.
No. Well, I think there are people who say that because Tony Blair has entered into his probably his last term, so he just wants to, he's very conscious of leaving a legacy, trying to be remembered for something he did very positively, and also in the light of the flak that he got from his involvement in Iraq, you know. So those are some of the reasons. But I think...
You think that the response to what happened in the tsunami, for example, might have made people more aware? Also concerns with terrorist breeding grounds.
Absolutely. This is a recurring thing. And I think one leader that has been very consistent in trying to point to the interrelationship between poverty in Africa and its effect on even the developed countries has been former President Clinton. I covered his visits in Africa when he went to Senegal, Ghana, and Nigeria. And he, in his addresses, he consistently said that, look, the world is interlinked now. And even HIV/AIDS, if you don't tackle it in Africa, it could... It just comes back to haunt you.
How is Bill Clinton seen in Africa? After some people were outraged when he went to the tarmac at the airport in Rwanda and said, well, we should have done more.
Well, President Clinton, as you know, has a great charisma, and that is something that most Africans remember him for. I mean, his visit to Nigeria, a lot of people remember him for the after-dinner party that he went on the floor dancing with the president of Nigeria and their wives, and everybody was were happy to see him do that. So... I think he's a lot of, but he was actually seen in Africa as a good friend of Africa. I cannot tell you whether that is as a result of anything substantive, but...
Well, he has applied certain pressure on pharmaceutical companies to help out in fighting AIDS.
He did that, and particularly also in South Africa, he was pretty much behind the campaign that led to... pharmaceutical companies actually cutting the cost of the drugs that were available to HIV patients in South Africa.
Last week, President Bush called for the expansion of programs to combat malaria, increasing aid to education, program to help combat sexual violence and address health care injustice issues. That all sounds very good, but it has little to do with developing the economies of these countries.
Well, I think these are all issues that have to be taken in totality. When I mentioned earlier about the action plan for Africa, the G8 action plan, it set out all those. The question now is, how do you actually implement this? This is where the countries themselves have to come up with a program. And this is where the new Partnership for Africa's Development, which Africans themselves have evolved as a sort of a Marshall Plan, is coming up with specific areas that they want to focus on, be it in investment or be it in education. They're going to come up with specific projects. But before they do that, they have given a commitment that the first thing is to clean up their house. That is to push towards greater democracy across Africa, to push towards the enshrining respect for human rights, and so on and so forth. And they have started this through a system called peer review, which is really that they look over each other's shoulder and see that, hey, you country A, you are not doing as well as you're supposed to do. You're pulling the rest of Africa down. And the first two countries to have been reviewed in this way, their reviews are now complete. That is Ghana and Rwanda. And donors and partners of Africa have made it very clear that in future, a country can expect to get more aid if it goes through that route, which is like what they used to demand in terms of going through an IMF program. But this now is a homegrown program by Africans themselves.
Although Africans seem to have been giving Robert Mugabe an awful lot of space. Why is he an exception?
You know, Zimbabwe is a very emotive issue. I think Robert Mugabe has gone to town on the issue of land. And that's kind of, it's something that a lot of ordinary Africans can understand. When you say that the Europeans came here and seized our land, and 75% of the best land belongs to about 4% of the population, people understand that. So the issues of human rights are a lot more difficult for ordinary people to comprehend.
Although then he levels the homes of Africans, not of whites who have been living in the country. U2's Bono has led a high-profile effort to get much of Africa's debt forgiven. Does that significantly help African governments?
It does, in the sense that it keeps the debt issue squarely on the global agenda. Nobody is saying, can say that that campaign alone would translate into money coming into Africa. But, I mean, why is the issue on the table of the G8 now? This is through a sustained campaign, the spearhead of which includes people like Bono.
Well, the $40 billion has been given forgiven so far, but the African Union wants all $350 billion forgiven. The U.S. says it won't go along with that until corruption is ended. What do you think is likely to be more effective, aid or debt forgiveness?
I think it has to be a combination of both, really, because there are some countries whose debt is not that big, but they still need they need aid coming in. They need assistance in the areas of education, the areas of health that I mentioned before. So it does have to be a combination of both. A country like Kenya, which was not among the 18, it feels that it has been actually penalized because of its own success, because it's doing fairly well economically. So it's been passed up this time. But Kenya does need some substantial injections of foreign aid from time to time, especially when it suffers from its tourist industry suffers as it did when it has the bomb attacks in Nairobi.
My guest is John Chiahemin, Reuters chief correspondent for Southern Africa, and this is an underreported segment on The Leonard Lopate Show. We will continue right after this. We're back with John Chiahemin, who's the Reuters chief correspondent for Southern Africa. On this underreported segment, we're looking into the impact of aid on Africa. But let's talk a bit about you. You're from Nigeria, but it seems to be one of the only countries you don't cover.
Well, I started my career, in fact, as a journalist in Nigeria. Reuters headhunted me from Nigerian television. And I had done quite a bit of work reporting internationally as well, including the end of the nationalist struggle in then Rhodesia. I actually met Robert Mugabe for the first time when I had to go look him out in his exile where he was directing his guerrilla army in neighboring Mozambique. I had just covered the Lancaster House talks in London that led to a transition program in then Rhodesia. They had allowed Joshua Nkomo, who was kind of like a fellow nationalist fighter with Mugabe. He ran the ZAPU side of the army, of the guerrilla army. Mugabe ran the ZANLA. They allowed Joshua Nkomo to return to a hero's welcome. And I was covering this for Nigerian television because Nigeria was at the forefront of the countries fighting for the liberation of Southern African states. So I did that, and it's from that that I got noticed by a lot of people.
Well, Reuters does cover Africa well. The French press does as well, but less in the United States. We tend to cover most of Africa as though it's just one abstract entity. And we're talking about countries with each with its own history, more than one culture often. How does that reflect in your work? How do you move from country to country quickly without losing that context when reporting the news?
Well, you know, Reuters does this by really the network of experienced African hands that are on the ground. We've got 180 people covering Africa, and 90% of these are Africans who know the story well, people like with a background like mine. And I'm glad you mentioned this problem of people treating Africa as one unit. You could never have done that with Europe. And when you take, for instance, a country like Democratic Republic of Congo, the former Zaire, it's more than twice the size of Western Europe, about three time zones. A lot of people don't know that, so you cannot generalize.
And Sudan is huge.
And Sudan itself, a country with borders, about nine countries bordering it. So it's a huge place, and you can't just generalize. This is what we've been emphasizing so much in our coverage in Reuters, that each country has its unique attribute and has to be seen close, in fact.
You are now the chair of the Foreign Correspondents Association of Southern Africa. Are you concerned about dangers to freedom of press in some countries? We've recently heard about reporters being either thrown in jail or sent into exile.
Yes, it's been a continuing problem, but I must say that it's not as bad as it used to be in the days of military regimes in Africa. One of the worst offenders now are countries, not surprisingly, Zimbabwe. I myself was not allowed to go to cover the last elections in Zimbabwe. Reuters submitted a list of several people, and only a fraction of those were allowed to go in, and it was done arbitrarily. But you should also remember that even in these sort of extreme cases, the legal process from time to time does play out, like as can be seen by a group of journalists from the Telegraph of the UK who were arrested at the time of the elections, and they were charged to court, and they successfully fought their case, and they returned to the UK.
The Live Aid 8 concerts were held last weekend. You wrote last week that you hoped that they wouldn't just show the problems, but also what African people and their governments are doing to help themselves. What did you see during those concerts?
Well, what I saw during the concerts was a commitment. It's again the bringing of an issue to public awareness.
But don't they also reinforce certain negative stereotypes because they focus on the problems of Africa?
Well, this is precisely why you see that the people who were getting on the stage in places like Johannesburg, the Life Aid in Johannesburg, they talked about the problems of Africa, but they also talked about the positive things in Africa. For instance, they said, look, music has always been a great weapon in the struggles in Africa, including the anti-apartheid struggle. So we're going to use that as a rallying cry to bring our people out to commit themselves more to trying to tackle their own problems. You heard those kind of statements.
But what we get mostly when we get coverage of Africa in American news media are civil wars, famine, diseases, including some pretty scary ones like Ebola and Marburg, natural disasters. What good things are we not hearing about Africa?
We are not hearing about the fact that Africa is beginning to interest outsiders who see it as quite a competitive place to go and invest and do trade. Pretty much the same way as China began to interest outsiders. I'll give you an example. I did mention the question of telecommunications, which has been a sector that has really shown a revolution. And the interesting thing about that is that we are seeing African countries leapfrogging on the back of technology, because the wireless telephone is easy to use, easy to install, easy to propagate. They embrace it fully. The same thing is happening in other sectors like banking. The UK bank Barclays has very recently done a deal to buy a major bank in South Africa.
60%.
60%. And the price tag is $5.3 billion. That's a lot of money. And not surprisingly, the governments of South Africa sees this as a vote of confidence in the economy, not just of South Africa, but Africa as a place to do business.
But the history of colonialism has always been you buy the natural resources of the colony cheap, you manufacture something and then sell it back to the colony and make a nice little profit in throughout the whole thing. Don't many, if not most, of the donor countries have trade policies that hurt African growers and African businesses? Would reducing or eliminating the European Union agricultural subsidies be more helpful to Africa than aid? And I guess by extension, some Chinese trade policies
as
well?
That is one issue that is also at the forefront of some of the proposals by Tony Blair, for instance. And it's not Western Europe has to do its part in terms of ending subsidies. The United States is also pushing. It has been cited in terms of its subsidies to its cotton farmers. But talking to U.S. officials, it's very clear that the United States wants to do a deal on that. It's prepared to tackle the issue of cotton subsidies, but it wants to do that in concert with Europe doing the same. So it has to be negotiated, and the negotiations are taking place through what they call the Doha round of trade talks.
What message was sent to Africa when, in February, President Bush asked that funds be cut, the funds allocated to aid for Africa be cut next year's budget?
Well, I think that would send a message that, but at the same time, you know that George Bush has also now proposed a doubling of U.S. aid to Africa. It may not be at the levels that, say, Tony Blair is demanding, but it is true. If you look at the figures, it has in fact doubled, although many Africans believe it can do better, take the lead in that.
Well, Africans are saying we have to do it ourselves first, and we talked about combating corruption. But how does that work? We've seen a number of cases where there have been popular rebellions, and then eventually they were put down, and the same old people wound up in power. Ivory Coast, for example.
Well, Ivory Coast is an ongoing is an ongoing thing. It's a very sad situation, because this is a country that for many years has been a beacon of economic success in West Africa, and it's the sort of thing that happens when the military do step in. whether as briefly as, even if it's just a brief period, this is a country that was not rocked by some of the military interventions that blighted other African countries. But in 1999, once the military stepped in, it has been going downhill. And one other good thing that has come out of that is that it has shown again the commitment of African countries themselves to try to tackle the issue of conflict resolution. South Africa is at the forefront of African efforts to try to resolve that.
South Africa has been pretty good in most of these things, although it has come into quite a bit of criticism for its policies in regard to HIV/AIDS, a story that you have been covering over the years. Even recently, the health minister has suggested that a lot of garlic and vitamins might be a better approach.
That's right.
Than drugs.
Yes, she's done that. And, of course, needless to say that she's kind of like swimming against the tide of public opinion, even in South Africa.
But do you see... Any chance to reverse this terrible situation where so many people have been infected?
Well, something that has to be tackled. The government definitely has to give a lead in that. When they give you their figures, they have embraced, finally agreed to the use of retrovirus, but they are not keeping pace with their own target. Finally, at least they, in theory, they have committed themselves to doing that.
Earlier in your career, you covered the independence movements in several southern African countries, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Angola, Mozambique, Namibia. Some of them have done rather well, and others remain in trouble. Are these just local problems, or are there other factors that would determine why one would succeed and another fail?
Well, Mozambique has always been cited as one of those that have done really very well. The economy has grown at a steady rate of more than 6%, 8%, in fact, up to double digits over the past 6 years or so. On the other hand, you have Angola, which...
Another former Portuguese colony.
They're both former Portuguese colonies. Angola was an unfortunate case because its case was complicated by the Cold War battles. It became a theater of the Cold War struggle between the United States and the former Soviet Union, with Cuba drawn into a conflict that stretched out for more than two decades.
Well, it's finally over, but the government remains repressive.
The lingering effects of that conflict are taking much longer to be dealt with than anyone ever imagined. I recently visited the hinterland of Angola, the city of Huambo, which was really so devastated. They haven't even got round to even trying to rehabilitate the victims of the war or the displaced people. A lot of money coming into the oil coffers and not making an impact.
You were a target when you were working in Sierra Leone. Is this job dangerous?
Oh yeah, it is a dangerous job. Not just in Africa, but as you know, the number of journalists that have unfortunately died in the line of fire have been too numerous now to document. We lost good people. Not just Reuters, we lost a very good reporter, an American in Sierra Leone at the height of the war there. So did AP. So, and not to mention what happened in Somalia several years before that.
And so Sierra Leone, also Uganda and other countries, Liberia, we've seen a lot of children soldiers.
Yes.
Is that going to be a problem in the future, reintegrating some of these kids into normal society before these countries can become stable?
Definitely. It has to be a carefully planned program. Organizations like UNICEF are taking a lead in trying to rehabilitate these children, because a lot of them got involved in fighting at such a young age that they don't know anything else to do.
I want to thank you so much for being with us on today's underreported segment. I've been talking with John Chiahaman, who is Reuters chief correspondent in South Africa. He has been reporting on sub-Saharan Africa for 25 years now. And what a great pleasure it was to have you on my show today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks for checking out today's podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.